And welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and here with me in the studio sharing the hosting chores this morning, Celeste Quinn.
Good morning.
Of Afternoon Magazine. We decided we wanted this morning on Focus to take this first opportunity that we would have to talk about yesterday's election and what it might mean for American politics. We also wanted to look at some of the challenges the next president will face. And we decided to change the format just a little bit, having the hours split up so that we could talk with four guests instead of just two. And we asked each of them to spend half an hour with us. And this hour, we'll be talking with a professor of political science here, try to talk a little bit about what lies ahead for the administration. And then in the second half hour, we'll concentrate on economic issues, because obviously that was one of the things that was most on people's minds. We know that yesterday when we went to the polls. And as always, we want to invite calls. But again, because we're running a little tighter here than usual, you can certainly call us, can certainly help us by keeping their comments brief. But of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, as I said, what we wanted to do here in this first half hour is to try to look at the challenges that now the president-elect is going to face.
We're going to take a look now at the coming transition and the challenges ahead. Our guest in this portion of Focus 580 is David Lewis, professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. His research interests include the presidency, executive branch politics, and public administration. He's the author of Presidents and the Politics of Agency Design and the Politics of Presidential Appointments, Political Control, and Bureaucratic Performance. Professor Lewis, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. The economy, healthcare, education, debt, two wars, the challenges are huge. So where does this incoming administration begin?
Well, I think by most accounts, they have to begin by getting a team in place to handle those pressing problems. I think my expectation is probably that the economic crisis and the two wars will be the things that they focus on first, and then quickly followed by the other issues that you mentioned.
And in terms of what has gone before, other incoming administrations we've seen over the last couple of decades, Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, how have these presidents handled the transition? And what, by looking back at history, is there something we can see about what is about to unfold now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the advantages that later serving presidents have is that they can learn from the things that previous presidents did well and did poorly. And from my reading of what this campaign has said about their transition, it seems like they've learned some of the lessons from past presidents. So, for example, President Clinton had a notoriously labored transition, and there are a couple of reasons why that was the case. One is that President Clinton himself delayed making decisions about key White House staff and instead jumped into making announcements about particular cabinet posts. And not having a White House staff in place before you started doing the work of governing and announcing who your candidates were led him to make a number of mistakes early on that derailed his agenda, that got him off to a bad start and generated bad publicity. The announcements coming from the Obama campaign are that a chief of staff could be announced as early as today, and I think the expectation is that senior White House staff will be announced relatively quickly. So that's the kind of thing that they learn about. They also learn that in a modern transition, you have to start incredibly early to lay out plans for the different departments and to identify the key positions that you want to fill first. And this campaign has begun that process as early as April or May. So I think they're well along the way of learning the lessons of past transitions.
Yeah. Mentioned as a possible chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. What do you think?
Well, I've heard that too. My expectation actually in advance was that it was going to be Tom Daschle. And my reasoning was the following. Emanuel's an ambitious politician in his own right. Mm-hmm. I think he's kind of on his way, if he stayed in the House, to being Speaker of the House someday. There was some expectation that maybe he would fill, or he could have alternately filled, Obama's Senate seat, the one that he's going to vacate when he becomes president. And Emanuel's he's a party creature. He really is a relatively partisan Democrat. And so I've heard all the chatter that you've heard, and it does seem like Emanuel's likely to be the choice, but he's a little bit surprising to me in that regard. He sends something of a different signal about the trajectory of the White House than someone like Tom Daschle would have.
We're expecting now this afternoon for our governor, Governor Rod Blagojevich, to name a successor to President-elect Obama this afternoon at 1:30 this afternoon.
Has there been chatter there about who's likely to fill that role, or has it been a pretty tightly kept secret?
And the list is long, and it's a very Byzantine kind of business here in Illinois. So we don't know. The speculation has even included Rod Blagojevich appointing himself. So there you have it. We've got a listener who is ready to join us now, listener in Urbana, on line one. You're on the air with political scientist David Lewis.
Hi. I know you're looking forward, but I just want to take a brief look back and comment on McCain's concession speech last night, which was very gracious, and I'm an Obama supporter, but I found it very moving. And I wonder if he had made a decision other than to bring in the Rove people, Schmidt, and then later Tucker Eskew, but had chosen Palin, but had her a happy warrior who is nice. I recall when I was watching the Republican convention, my stomach churned at just the nastiness of Giuliani, of Romney, and then Palin's speech herself was just over-the-top sort of stuff. If they had campaigned with a sort of graciousness that McCain spoke last night and focused on the issues, he would have solidified his base with Palin. She would still have been everything the evangelicals wanted. Could they have made this closer? I don't think they could have won, but it seemed to me that a lot of people were just turned off by this endless sort of, have you stopped beating your wife yet? Why? We don't know. Tell us. We don't know whether you're beating your wife, but, you know, we just need you to address this question. You know, that sort of stuff was just endless, endless, endless. And it was just ugly. And McCain last night was back to the old McCain that, you know, many of us had some sort of affection for before this last 4 months.
What might have been, David Lewis?
Yeah, I think you raise an interesting question, which is whether they deployed Sarah Palin effectively during the campaign. My view on this is that it's difficult. It would have been difficult for her to energize the base as the happy warrior, as you call her. As a candidate herself, she's probably more effective not in that role. She's probably more effective as a candidate in the happy warrior role. But McCain had a weakness with the right in the Republican Party, and he was concerned, in my view, that they weren't going to turn out, that they weren't going to give money. And in order to drum up support among those people, to generate enthusiasm, I think they calculated that they needed to throw them some red meat. I think your larger point about McCain and your reactions to his concession speech are consistent with mine, and that is that the brand McCain that we saw in 2000, the Straight Talk Express, somehow got muddled in this presidential campaign, that we were left wondering, who is this candidate? He had moved to the right to win the nomination, and that left kind of moderate Republicans confused as to who he was. But the right never fully embraced him, and there was sort of a lukewarm nature to his candidacy, which I think forced him to thrust Sarah Palin into the role of getting their support. And so it was a difficult campaign for McCain to run, and that's not even mentioning the fundamentals of the campaign, the wars and the state of the economy and so forth.
Just let's very quickly, for anybody who might have joined us, introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580. He's David Lewis. He's professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. This morning on Focus, we're talking about yesterday's election, what lies ahead. In the second half of this hour, we've split him up. We have a professor of economics here from the U of I, so we're kind of trying to concentrate on those issues. And also here, sharing the host responsibilities with me this morning, is Celeste Quinn. 333-9455 is the number if you'd like to call in, toll-free 800-222-9455.
And let's take another call. David, where do we go next?
I think that next we'll be talking with somebody on line number two, right here. And I'm not sure where you're calling from, but please go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling from Champaign, actually.
Okay.
And something I'm curious about on television as well as on the net, several of these commentators were saying that it wasn't clear that he has a mandate, that Obama has a mandate, and based on what's happened, comparable, let's say, to Reagan and so forth. Certainly, Reagan's numbers in terms of the Electoral College were extremely high, but from what I understand, this is the first non-incumbent to win 52%, which is higher than Reagan did in '80 at 51%, and since 1952, I believe, for a non-incumbent. And the since the 1930s, I heard, it's been since the Democrats won two general elections in succession with a strong lead, in other words, in the Congress and so forth. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on whether he has a mandate. Also, with the Senate, it looks very likely that the Democrats will have anywhere from 58 to 60 seats, because even if Ted Stevens wins, we assume he'll be fired, right? I mean, unless he wins in court. But
Professor Lewis, what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm always a little bit mandates are difficult things to sort of interpret. I do agree with the caller that this is a pretty impressive victory. You know, it looks like nationally it'll be 6 or 7 points, and the Electoral College vote, you know, shows a decided win for Obama. And so as far as mandates go, this is a pretty strong one, certainly the strongest for a Democrat since probably LBJ in 1964. You know, but what it's a mandate for, apart from change, you know, needs to be defined by the campaign. And one of the goals during the transition is going to be to say, here's what we ran on, here are the priorities, here are the things that we're going to do first. But as far as mandates go, I agree. I think this is there's a good argument to be made that there is a mandate for some change. Now it's sort of defining what that change is that's the task of the transition.
If I'm correct, I don't think Barack Obama used that word in his speech last night.
No.
Mandate.
No. It seems
all interesting.
The commentary and commentators, they're using the word mandate. Right. He certainly didn't say anything like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's, I think, intentionally avoiding that word, and I think he'll probably work across the aisle, perhaps ask Colin Powell to do something, for example, in the administration. But in historical terms, it is quite incredible since 1952,
yeah.
First
yeah.
time a non-incumbent to get 52%, very and a Democrat in this case. So yeah. Anyway, thank you very much.
All right.
That leads me to this question. Will there be a honeymoon, and what do you expect will eventually strain that honeymoon?
Well, I think there's going to be a honeymoon. I think that if the press coverage that the election victory has gotten so far is any indication, I think there will be a honeymoon. I think that during this period, there is a tendency for both parties to take a wait-and-see approach. So, you know, what that means is even the Republican Party is sort of keeping a low profile, being, you know, kind of waiting to see what's happened, see what the initial proposals are, see who the candidates are. And because they're silent, even Republican voters begin to say, you know, maybe this is okay, let's see what this guy has to offer. And so there's a natural tendency to have a honeymoon. The length of the honeymoon and the effectiveness of the honeymoon in terms of translating policy proposals into real outcomes depends on the ability of the campaign to capitalize on the momentum they have, not to get sidetracked by issues like bad nominations or $200 haircuts, things that plague President Clinton, and prioritize, have some early victories, and show Washington that you know that you're someone to be reckoned with.
Just real quick, something I'm curious about. You know, this administration, the Bush administration, has been heavily criticized for having a very expansive view of executive power. Now, here for the first time in a long time, we have a president and a vice president who've come from the Congress. Do you think that that says anything about what sort of how they might indeed frame executive power and the relation, how they might think about the relationship between the executive and the legislative branches?
That's a good question. I mean, I think particularly, you know, it'll be true that since the candidates were legislators, that they're more sensitive to expansion of executive power. But from the things that the campaigns have said and from what the Obama campaign has said about issues of presidential power that I've been attuned to, things like the number of political appointees or presidential appointees that there are going to be, Obama's views on things like signing statements. He is not going to roll back presidential power to the degree that some people would like. I mean, one of the interesting things about people's views about presidential power is that they change depending upon whether it's your president that's in office or the other party's president that are in office. And so the same partisans that were complaining about President Bush's abuse of executive power will be more lenient with a President Obama because they'll trust the way that their president will use the power and agree with the way that power is used.
Speaking of Congress, there was a piece in the New York Times Magazine on Sunday written by journalist Matt Bye. He wrote, one of the things he wrote, congressional majorities are a lot like corporate profits. They exist on paper, but that doesn't mean they're actually there when you need them. What lies ahead for relations between the two branches?
Well, I think it's easy to say that the you know, that congressional relations are going to be easier with unified party control. The difficulty arises when the president-elect has to deal with people who exist in the House and the Senate who have long seniority, that have a proprietary feeling toward the committees that they oversee and certain policy areas that they have expertise in. I mean, one of the big problems that President Clinton had was that he couldn't capitalize on Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate when he assumed office in 1993. It was a bunch of, you know, the old bulls in the House and the Senate that resisted his attempts to push through his economic proposals, his health care plan. They all wanted their piece. They all wanted their say. And as a consequence, Clinton suffered for it, both politically and electorally, in the midterm elections in 1994. Now, I think Congress is a bit of a different place now than it was then. I think Obama is going to encounter some resistance from people in his own party, but I think it'll be a bit more muted. That the Democrats now have had the experience of being out of power. They've suffered the consequences of not cooperating effectively, and so they'll be a bit chastened, but not chastened a terrible amount.
Why don't we take another call? David, where are we going?
We're going to somebody on a cell phone. This will be line number three. Hello.
Hi. In the beginning of the program, there was a list of priorities for the Obama administration, and a glaring omission, I would say, would be the problems we have with energy, environment, global warming. And actually, I don't think it's I think it's telling that it was left out of the list in this program, though I love this program. It's a great program. I think that that's something that people are going to be inclined to forget. I'm also disturbed by, I'm as excited about the Obama election as the next guy, but I think they're going to be inclined to forget this kind of thing when talking about what to do about it. Obama led his convention speech, his renewable energy started with clean coal. That's a fantasy at this point. It doesn't exist, and yet I can see, you know, billions if not trillions being thrown away while we're, you know, not really solving any problems. And I wonder if the guests could address what the mood is in Washington and also what people who can see the folly of this should do about it.
All right, Professor Lewis, you pick up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the point's an interesting one. The campaign has talked about, you know, the closest thing they've talked about recently is energy independence, which is, you know, it's not global warming, it's not environmental policy. I'll say a couple of things about that. The people who have been giving advice to the Obama campaign about environmental issues are people who are sympathetic to efforts to constrain global warming. One place where I see them likely to make an immediate direct effort in that direction is that probably there'll be an economic stimulus package, and some part of that package is likely to be stimulus targeted towards the development of clean energy technologies of some type or another, and I don't know what that'll look like. There's also been some chatter about bringing Al Gore in to be some sort of ambassador at large for environmental issues, and he could beat the drum for it. But I share the caller's perceptions about what's been talked about, and the environment and global warming has taken a backseat to economic issues and the two wars for sure.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to leave it off the list. I just thought, you know, well, we've got so much.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure, and as far as this program is concerned, we have tried to promote some discussion of these issues, and I'm sure we will. One of the things that I would certainly invite people who listen to Focus 580 in the afternoon magazine to do is, you know, make suggestions about things that you'd like to hear us talk about, and we always do our best to act on that.
Should we take another call?
Let's try and do at least one more call, and that's someone in St. Charles, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for letting me on again. You know, I agree with you guys. There's a lot of good topics that you guys come up with. I think it's a great show that you always have, regardless of what the topic is, and great, intelligent people, and I'm trying to be like all the rest of the people calling there. But my concern is this. He just talked about environment, you know, environmental issues, and, you know, how he is, like Obama has people, you know, that are probably tied into that one way or another. And it's fine and dandy, but the problem is you're buying one side over the other. And a good example is what happened in the election. I honestly believe John McCain got handed him kind of a raw deal with Sarah Palin. And his own, I actually, being an ex-Republican, understand that you know, the Republicans didn't help him, I think, personally, one iota. It just makes, to me, it just, everybody was bashing Bush for the last 2, 3, 4 years. And they focused on that, and they did a great job, the Obama camp did, on focusing on that one issue, which I think is wrong because, you know, at the same time, we're talking about two guys that are running for the most powerful job in the world. And, you know, I still am very uninformed when it comes to some of his policy, Obama's policies, what he's going to do to right the, you know, the things that are going wrong in this country, because he didn't really explain it. He came out with a lot of stuff he said he might do, but he didn't say, like, which I used to like is a...
I'm going to jump in because we're running down on time.
All right, guys.
The caller is feeling some frustration and is, I would say, a little anxious about what's to come. David Lewis?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there is some general frustration with the level of discourse in the campaign, and I think that's, you know, sort of at root of the caller's concerns, that there's, you know, so much focus on sound bites and modern communication strategies that it gets difficult to sort of pin down exactly what's going to happen. And I think to some extent, front-runner candidates like Obama have an incentive not to be as specific so they don't tie their hands once they get into office. And so part of what we're going to see in the next couple of months is a translation of kind of vague policy ideas into concrete proposals. And the fact that they're vague allows increases the probability that something gets through Congress. So I think it's sort of part of modern presidential politics. It's an unfortunate part, but we don't get down into the weeds in policy details in debates and advertisements and journalistic discussion.
Another question that I have here before we're out of time completely. Closing days of the Bush administration and the lame duck Congress. What do you expect?
Well, I think the sort of traditionally what we would expect to see happen are a couple of things. One is that the Bush administration will try to finish up a bunch of rules that they've had in construction for a while. That is, administrative agencies take vague statutes and they translate them into concrete policies through the rulemaking process. And the Bush administration will sort of push through the sort of last set of those things and try to leave their final stamp on the administration. There'll be some people in the Bush administration that will try to switch from appointed positions into career positions in the executive branch. This is a process called burrowing. And then there'll be some sort of transition-related activities where there'll be kind of a delicate dance where the Obama campaign will not want to appear like they're the president yet and kind of let Bush finish out his term, and he'll be hesitant to make some decisions. I do expect that there's going to be some action on some economic policy in between now and the inauguration day, and I think we're all curious to see what role Obama will play in that.
All right. Well, in fact, that gives us a good kind of lead-in
segue
to what we'll be doing for the final half hour. We thought, certainly because economic issues were uppermost on everyone's mind, that for this last half hour, we'd concentrate on economics, and we'll be doing that in just a moment. We have a guest here, Ann Villamil, who's professor of economics here at the U of I, to talk with us. Any last thoughts you just might like to leave with folks, Professor Lewis?
I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to happen in the transition. I think it's going to be an important indicator of how the rest of the presidency is going to go. If it goes smoothly, if they prioritize carefully, then I think we can feel optimistic about what's going to happen the next 2 or 3 years. If it gets off to a slow start, that's a real bad indicator for the way the rest of the presidency is going to go.
Well, David Lewis, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, or this morning.
Thank you for having me.
David Lewis is professor of politics at Vanderbilt University.
Right. You're listening to Focus 580. I'm David Inge, and with me is Celeste Quinn. We thought we'd like to do something a little bit different here for the day after the election. Of course, as always, we want to give people the opportunity to tell us what's on their minds and to ask questions. But we also wanted to take the opportunity to talk about some of the major issues here, talk about the election, talk about what lies ahead. And so we thought, well, we try to split things up, and actually, instead of what we usually would do, it mostly it's one guest, 1 hour. We thought, well, let's split that up and have four and ask each of the guests to spend half an hour with us, and try to move it a little bit to greater clip. And I'm sure, as I said, I'm sure that some of the things we're talking about here this morning, we're going to keep talking about. We'll talk about it on future programs. But we certainly wanted to concentrate at least for one segment here on the economy and economic issues because, as I now have said several times, we know this was the big thing that was on people's minds. And to do that, we have in the studio with us this morning Ann Villamil. She is professor of economics here at the U of I. She's been here before on this program, and we're pleased she could spend some more time with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And I want to also, again, tell people who are listening, questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Anywhere that you can hear us, if you're listening over the air around Indiana, Illinois, if you're listening on the Internet, use the toll-free line. And again, we just ask people to try to be brief so we can get as many as possible. Well, I think that the question here to pick up on where we left off with the last guest. Now, obviously, we know we're going to have a new president and a new administration, but also for a couple of months here, we're going to continue with President Bush and the current Congress, and there will continue to be the opportunity for them to try to move things along with addressing what's going on with the economy. What do you think might be likely to happen here with the end of the Bush administration?
I think it is entirely going to be determined by the economy. If the economy stabilizes a bit, then I think we won't see a stimulus package, and we'll just wait until we go into the new administration. On the other hand, if we continue to see worrisome signs, then there could be possibly, a mild stimulus package, and then potentially something more when the new administration is fully in place.
Was there any consensus about what the effect of the last stimulus package was? I know that a lot of people ask questions about, well, what would people do with the money? Would they just sock it away? Would they go out and spend it? Would it make much difference?
Right. Well, you know, as always with economic data, it takes time to collect it, and then one needs to look back in retrospect. But the preliminary results on that are that most people saved the $600 that they got. And really, that's not so surprising because we've had a huge increase in debt. And so when people have a lot of debt and the economy starts looking at the very least uncertain, then people are inclined to say, well, I better, back off and be a bit conservative and wait and see how things turn out. Now, remember, mm-hmm. this stimulus, most of the checks were issued in May. Right? And so that was well before we had this financial crisis. So now, if there were a stimulus package, given the increased level of uncertainty, I can't imagine that we would do something like that again. Because the idea of the stimulus would be to encourage people to go out and buy things to keep the economy going. But again, with this big level of debt, they're not going to do that. So any kind of proposal would have to be structured differently.
Hmm.
So people who would spend would be, for example, people who are unemployed. So I think if we see anything, it's going to be much more targeted.
Oh, interesting.
So you just to make sure I'm clear, it sounds like you're saying that it wouldn't be like the last time where they sent out a check to everybody,
right.
No matter who you were.
I don't foresee that. And one of the reasons is that we've done a lot of intervention, which I think we needed to do with regard to the financial crisis. But there's a large there are two types of debt out there. One is increasing government debt, which you know, there are certain expenditures that we need to do in recessions, and we did need to respond to the financial crisis. But there is also a high level of personal debt, consumer debt.
Can we expect to see further intervention in the financial sector?
Again, that will entirely depend on what happens. Yeah. It's starting to look like things are stabilizing. But, you know, this still continues to be, maybe it's not day to day now, but week to week. So, you know, if things stabilize, then I'm sure everyone would be pleased to say we've done enough and let's give this some time to work. But that was a pretty scary crisis.
Yeah. You know, I was very struck by something. One of the many analysts that I heard this morning, specifically talking about the economy, said something to the effect of, as far as the markets were concerned, it didn't matter that much to them who was elected, McCain or Obama, because whoever the next president is, their options really are quite limited.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
do you think that that's true?
Well, you know, they're limited in the following sense. When we had this severe financial crisis, we had to act. So in that sense, the options were limited. And furthermore, remember that the U.S. initially wanted to have this, it wanted to buy up assets. It did not want to intervene directly in banks, take shares, basically. Mm-hmm. And it had to. Why is that? Because Europe said, well, this is what we're going to do. And remember, we're in a global capital market now. And so that imposes certain constraints. If one country reacts and another country doesn't react, then people are going to say, it looks like my funds are going to be safer in one place rather than another, and those funds are going to move. So that limits, so there are two things that limit our options. One is that we're a global economy, and the other thing that limits our options is the budget deficit.
Mm-hmm. We've got some listeners who have joined us now, and I guess we could go to the phone.
Sure, let's do that. And we'll start with someone in Belgium, the community nearby, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question a bit more parochial to us here in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a favorite son elected as president, just what kind of advantage does that really bring to your state? I'm sure George Bush sent quite a bit of stuff going his way, and Lord only knows whoever did it in the past. But is there really an economic advantage to having a favorite son as a president?
You know, I'm actually not really sure about that. I do think that, you know, there may be some, but those types of things that may have occurred in the past, I think it's going to be more limited. You know, there's a lot of information out there in terms of who's getting what. I think Obama has been very clear on, you know, for example, he talked about lobbyists, that there wouldn't be access in his administration. So, you know, I think he's set a high standard, and you know, people are going to be watching.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to Bloomington, Illinois, then, for our next caller. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David and Celeste. Applaud your format. Wonderful show. Very informative. Kind of gives a good overview on a number of topics. Just real quick, and you touched on it, I was taken back by something Tom Brokaw said, that regardless of who the winner is going to be, he's probably going to demand a recount, given the severity of all the problems. But I was wondering, you touched on it, the economy, the situation, one of the other pundits said, it's really Obama's really going to be quite limited as to what he can do. He can kind of move around the margins, but this situation could take the entire amount of his first term, and people think that this is going to go away overnight, and it's just not. And I don't know if maybe you want to comment on that. I'll go ahead and hang up. Thanks.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that it is going to take some time to unwind this. But having said that, there are a lot of other things that need to be done. For example, looking at regulations that got us into this, or lack of enforcement of regulations, inappropriate regulations that got us into the financial mess. There's plenty of room to look at something like that, for example. So so I think that, you know, and also, though this was promised, you know, 8 years ago, I do think this idea of changing the way people address these problems, you know, getting people down to work to try and address these very serious problems. One of the good things of a crisis, and I don't want to sound too Pollyanna on this, but when you have a crisis, it focuses the mind because people need to sit down and they really need to start making decisions and make the tough choices. And that's the situation we're in right now. Hmm. So, you know, and I don't see when we have problems, a lot of these solutions are going to be solutions that are going to have to be phased in over time. So, for example, if you look at something like healthcare, it's not reasonable to expect that somebody's going to wave a magic wand and all of that is going to be solved. There are going to be incremental changes that need to be made.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier people banking that stimulus check. You know, here we are. My gosh, we're saving.
Yeah,
and you know, thinking about the debt and the deficit, we have a $700 billion deficit, a $10 trillion national debt. What's the outlook long term for our wealth as a country?
Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, McCain got in trouble for this in the economy, but you know, something he said was true. The U.S. is a strong economy, so that debt level is high and it's worrisome. But, you know, if we make the right choices over time and we get the economy growing again, then we'll be able to manage that debt. So just to give you a sense, sometimes it's helpful. Those are big numbers. Sometimes it's helpful to look at those numbers in terms of GDP. So our outstanding debt, you know, is probably about 65% of GDP right now. Now, this is not including the stuff we added recently. And the direction of that debt is definitely up. But that's a manageable level. It was the case, you know, what a lot of people perhaps don't remember is in 2000 when Bush took over, we actually had a budget surplus and we actually had declining debt. And if we can get the economy growing again and make some good choices, in the long term, we are going to return to a good growth path. The question is, you know, how long it will take.
Can we just real quick, for people who might have joined us, I'd like to reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580, Ann Villamil. She's professor of economics here at the University of Illinois, doing something a little different here this morning with Focus 580, with splitting up the hours and sharing the hosting with Celeste Quinn, the host of the Afternoon Magazine. We wanted to devote this last half hour to discussion of economic issues because we thought that probably was the thing that people were thinking about most. And as we look ahead, it's a good opportunity to ask some questions about what might happen. People who are listening, of course, are welcome to call in with questions, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455.
Smart choices, hard choices. What's ahead for entitlement programs?
Yeah, those are big choices. I mean, particularly Medicaid, Medicare. That is a tough program to deal with. You know, the good news is that people are living longer. The good news is that we have a lot of technologies that can prolong people's lives, improve the quality of their lives, but therein lie some of the problems, that these technologies are expensive. And so we really, you know, we need to rethink what we're going to do there. I mean, you know, some of the issues have been talked about for a while. So cutting administrative costs, sure, everybody is in favor of that. But even basic things like trying to put more things online, for example, you know, there have been estimates that this would reduce costs, but a lot of people are then concerned about medical privacy, for example. So there are a lot of issues, and that's, you know, an issue of medical privacy. That's not an issue that involves money. That's an issue that involves some additional legislation so that people cannot be excluded, for example, for pre-existing conditions or propensities for certain diseases. So, you know, those are going to be tough choices.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening here in Urbana, line one.
Professor Venable, as a trade specialist, I wanted to ask you your reaction and opinion on Obama's trade policy. During the debate with McCain, he kind of repeated and often AFL-CIO charge that Colombia had too high a level of union membership or whatever who were killed. In fact, that's inaccurate. And the Democratic Congress has been unwilling to go ahead with CAFTA, the Central America, the trade agreement with Colombia, despite the fact that Colombia, if you look at the context of its neighborhood with Venezuela and Bolivia and so forth, and Nicaragua, is one of our few friends in the area. The fact that we've been dragging our feet on this has, in effect, undermined the presidency of Uribe and our friends in Latin America. Now, I can understand that during an election cycle where the Democratic presidential nominee wants to the support of the trade unions, the AFL-CIO, you would pursue a strong pro-union position. But, of course, when you become president and have to weigh the importance of globalization and trade, you have to consider the effects of inflation on protectionism, what protection does in terms of stoking up inflation, making imports more expensive, and also protecting jobs, which may be in a more rational situation, should be, moved overseas, whereas the United States economy benefits enormously from free trade. So I wanted to get your take on what you think the direction of free trade under the Obama administration would be. Thank you.
You know, my sense is that he's certainly going to appreciate the importance of free trade, but I do think, given all of the other problems on the table at the moment, it's likely not to be his highest priority, especially, you know, remember, a recession has not yet been called in the U.S., but I think most people are expecting one. And it really depends on what happens with unemployment. I mean, I accept your point that that trade is very, very important. But you know, there are times when it's easier to achieve certain policies, and times when it's harder. And that, I think, just realistically, in a recession, that's probably going to be more difficult.
So who, now just to pick up on your point about the recession hasn't been called yet, so who calls it and when does it get called?
The National Bureau of Economic Research. So they'll have a meeting and the NBR, because they look at, so the kind of layman's view of a recession is two quarters of back-to-back negative GDP growth. So we actually just had last week the announcement of our first quarter of negative GDP growth, and it was only 0.3%. And so that's why, so by that measure, people should be feeling pretty good. So are they confused, or is there something else going on here? And it's clearly that there's something else going on here. That is that the NBR looks at a broader list of measures, and they look at things like unemployment. Now, if you look at unemployment, even that right now is 6.1%, which by historical standards is not high. But there's a lot of concern in the economy. Industrial production is going down. You know, certainly the credit crisis, a number of other factors. So yeah. I do expect that that will be called. But it is the case that usually by the time a recession has been called, we're partway through it.
Again, well, I want to thank the caller, and we have just maybe about 5-6 minutes left. So if someone wants to get in real quick with another question, we'd be happy to take them. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
What role does emotion play in this? It seems to me maybe this, you can get to a point where it feeds on itself.
Sure. Well, consumer confidence, that's another index that came out last week, and it dropped precipitously. So there's a lot of concern about that. Now, consumption is more than two-thirds of GDP in the U.S. It's actually close to right now to about 71% of the economic pie, so to speak. So when consumers become pessimistic, they cut back. Now, the thing that's difficult about this particular episode is that, you know, sometimes there's just fear and people are panicked. But sometimes there are real problems, and we've got some real problems. So you talked about this issue of savings rates being very low. Personal savings rates recently have actually been negative. What does that mean? You know, minus 0.5%. Well, what it means is that people were borrowing, not saving. So with the crisis, the personal savings rate has gone up a little bit. It's already gone up to 2.8%. you know, expected to get back to historical levels of maybe something like 10%. But those kinds of adjustments need to occur. Consumption and savings are just opposite sides of the same coin. So some of that is going to go down. But again, we don't want to see this undue panic.
Yeah. You know, I think some people would have made the argument that the reason that the crisis was as bad as it was is that here in this country, from all the way from the individual consumer to the level of very big businesses and corporations, we were very heavily leveraged.
Absolutely.
There was a tremendous amount of debt, and there would have been people who would have said that was a problem. And I wonder if now there would be more people who would say, you know, that level of debt is just not healthy, and we just shouldn't go there again.
Right. Well, you know, kind of an informal maxim in economics is anything that's underpriced is overconsumed. And so the interest rates have actually been very low. Bernanke has talked about this as a so-called global savings glut. So there are some countries in the world that have been saving a lot. You know, those funds have been coming to the U.S. and interest rates have been pretty low. And so people took on a lot of debt across the board.
Mm-hmm. It seemed for a while things were so red hot.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, where are we going to head with inflation? Being a youngster in the 70s, you know, that was a horrible period of inflation. And now suddenly we're talking about deflation.
Right. Well, and that's an important point because people sometimes think if inflation is bad, deflation has to be good, and nothing could be further from the truth. What we really want is price level stability, because when we have a more stable environment, people can save and invest and make better decisions.
Have you heard anything interesting, because now everybody's talking about the cabinet,
mm-hmm.
Anything interesting in the way of speculation about who might be named as the next Secretary of the Treasury?
Well, I guess the one name is Larry Summers, who was a Treasury Secretary before. So he certainly has a lot of experience. The names that have been batted around so far have actually been, you know, very serious, well-qualified people, and that's a very good thing.
Hmm. How does President-elect Obama, on the one hand, comfort us, prepare us for hard choices, and yet keep our confidence up?
Yeah. You know, he seems to be able to do that. This idea that there's hope, you know, when there are tough times immediately before us, as long as people see that, well, you know, we're gonna have, you know, a few quarters, a year of maybe some difficulties, but then we're gonna get back on a good growth path. I think that's the key, that there is a strong future in front of everyone.
No, certainly we know that emotion has the power to move markets,
mm-hmm.
and that the way people feel, are they confident, are they worried, that's going to influence their decisions. And I suppose that truly is the question now. Is there something for people to grab onto to feel at least a little bit of optimism that would say, yes, things are not real good, and it's going to take a while, but eventually things are going to turn around.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's clearly true. And also maybe telling people that, look, things may get a little worse before they get better, but they're going to get better. Right. Right now, there's so much uncertainty and so much volatility that, mm-hmm. that people just think, gee, you know, what's going on? And the other thing that happens is when we have a recession, when we have a financial crisis, people feel like they've never happened before, or the only other time they happened was the Great Depression. Since World War II, there have been 10 recessions. There was a recession in 2001. There was a recession in 91. And we can go back. So, you know, we do and we have gotten through them.
Well, we got one more caller. We're trying to squeeze in here. Someone in Chicago. Line number four. Hi.
There's concern about the currency and other countries no longer accepting American currency. And perhaps going to other sources of reconstructing the currency, such as the Amero. Europe has the Euro. Do you think we would have a something between America, Mexico, and Canada shaping up as a currency?
No, I actually don't foresee Canada, the U.S., and Mexico having a common currency area in the short term. But your point is certainly correct. Now that Europe has the Euro and there are 15 Euro countries, and that's expanding, you know, the dollar has been what's known as a reserve currency, and for the most part, I mean, this isn't entirely true, but if not the only, it was the major game in town, and it's not anymore. The euro is a strong currency.
On the other hand, recently we've seen the strength of the dollar go up against other currencies, and it's a good news, bad news situation. It depends what kind of business you're in, I suppose. But what's the future near term for the dollar?
Well, oh boy, it's always difficult predicting, but particularly exchange rates. They're extremely volatile, but probably, and it depends on with respect to what currency, but given that Fed discount rate is 1% here, it's about 4% in Europe. In Europe, Europe has more room to lower, so it's likely that the dollar, at least relative to the euro, will strengthen a bit in the short run.
Hmm. We're just about the point where we have to finish. Any last sort of thought or idea, or is it some point we haven't touched on that you'd like to make?
Well, I think it's just encouraging that we still have all the same economic problems, but it's actually nice to be looking forward about them. I think that's key.
I heard an analyst this morning from ADM say the markets, in his opinion, he thinks that the markets are going, whew, we know who's going to be the next president. We're not at 2000. So that was a confidence booster there.
Right.
You agree?
Well, now we can get to work on these problems, right? That's the issue. It's time to roll up our sleeves and get to work on the problems.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. And we want to thank our guest, Anne Villamil, for this half hour of Focus 580. She is professor of economics here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And certainly I want to say thanks to all the people who called in this morning. And as I've said earlier here, promise that all of these issues, I'm sure we'll be talking about them in the weeks and months ahead. And, of course, suggestions for future topics are welcome.